Elbphilharmonie Talk, der Gesprächspodcast der Elbphilharmonie.
Hello and welcome to a new episode of Elbphilharmonie Talk. I'm Tom Schulz, principal host of this podcast series of Elbphilharmonie Hamburg. June 23rd this year marked the end of an era in music. On this Sunday night, just 2 days after summer solstice, two members of the Kronos Quartet, who had been instrumental in shaping the identity of this outstanding string quartet since the late 70s of the 20th century, retired, the violinist John Scherber and the viola player Hank Dutt. With their final performance at the annual four-day Kronos Quartet Festival in San Francisco, also the 50 years celebration of Kronos Quartet as such came to an end. John Scherber and Hank Dutt passed the torch to two young women, the violinist Gabriela Diaz and the violist Ayana Kosasa. So Kronos Quartet will enter its sixth decade now with two male and two female members eager to take part in shaping the future of music just as they did in the last half century. A few weeks before, the group had travelled to Europe, still in the old lineup. The tour included a couple dates in Germany, one took place in our Grand Hall, another one nearby in Hannover at Kunstfestspiele Herrenhausen. I seized the opportunity then and spoke to founding member and first violin David Harrington and Kronos cellist and composer Paul Wianco, who has joined the group just some years ago. We talked about the early years, the hurdles Kronos had to overcome, and its very, very close relationship to so many composers of the last 50 years and of our time. Our conversation got very personal when David Harrington told me about the biggest grief in his life and what role music plays in dealing with it each and every day. I also learned about the ongoing ignorance about contemporary music, especially in the US, which eventually inspired Kronos to launch a massive educational project called 50 for the Future. It's a great project indeed, intended to enhance the playing experience of musicians in all categories with contemporary compositions. Kronos Quartet has premiered over 1,000 works written for them. There's a huge catalogue of outstanding recordings. They have been decorated with innumerable awards. And if there should have been any doubt about whether or not music can change the world, well, Kronos did. Not only within the ivory tower of chamber music, but in the world of music at large. The Los Angeles Times did not exaggerate when it dubbed Kronos to be the most far-ranging ensemble the world has known. And, good news, its founder David Harrington, now in his 70s, is maybe further from wishing to retire himself than he ever was. I hope you enjoy my conversation with this very wise and kind man, an old soul with a young, adventurous spirit, and with Paul Wianco, master cellist and composer, who anchors this group not only via the lower frequencies of his instrument, but also with the strength and gentleness of his impressive personality. 50 years Kronos, of course, this is a huge reason to celebrate, and speaking about the Greek gods, I mean, there is a Kronos with CH and there is a Kronos with K. And I think you, David, when you were founding this ensemble, you had more the Kronos with K in mind, or at least you had the K in mind because it looked cooler. The question I'm asking myself is, and which I'm asking you now, is wouldn't it have been just as appropriate to call the quartet Kairos Quartet rather than Kronos?
It very well could have been, and my wife and I did not find Kairos in the Greek and Roman mythological dictionary we were consulting that night. So it gets down to really, you know, what you happen to gravitate towards in a certain moment, and then you go for it. And that's what we did.
And it stuck, of course, with you. I was wondering the distinction between those two Kronos types. The one was God's, Zeus's father, and the other one was apparently just a medium important god who was dealing with time and who was not really worshipped anything. Were you more into the CH, into the time Kronos, or did you really want to go to the wild kind of devouring Kronos with K.
Well, in October of 1973, when my wife and I realized that we needed a name, that I needed a name for this group, because we had a concert in November, our first concert, and we got out our Greek and Roman mythological dictionary, because I definitely wanted something that was old, something that would propel things from a long time ago and throw it into the future. That was the idea. And that's why we opened that dictionary that night. And she came across the word, the god Kronos, Chronos. Mm-hmm. And the idea of time and timeliness and chronicle and chronic, and that really appealed to me. And the only reason we went with a K was because I had recalled something from when I was a teenager, reading in the Reader's Digest about how Kodak Company got its name and how they spent hundreds of thousands of dollars to be told that a word starting with a K was more dramatic than a word starting with CH. And so that's how Kodak became K-O-D-A-K.
With two Ks even.
With two
beginning
Ks.
At the ending. Yeah.
Right. And I just remembered that. And so I thought, okay, we'll go with Kronos, but let's spell it with a K.
Cool.
And it wasn't for about 2 years later that I learned that was an entirely different god, an entirely different idea. So ignorance was part of my life then and now. You know?
Fantastic. You just mentioned the word chronic also coming out of this. And of course, there's some time of playing with time and timelessness. And somehow, Kronos Quartet has always been so much with time, dealing with the time we are living in. And at the same time, of course, there have been timeless pieces that have been premiered by you, that have been written for you. How does that feel like? I mean, it's something like, even like the golden cut of numbers of years that you have meanwhile in your life, to have like the most portion of it being dedicated to this endeavor, Kronos Quartet, this timeless entity.
When I wake up in the morning, I don't think, oh, God, it's been 50 years, 50 years in one day, 50 years in 2 days. I've never, ever thought about that. It's the 50 years is something that has happened because I have been able to do exactly what I've wanted to do ever since I was 14 years old. And there's been a whole lot of people that have helped me be able to do exactly what I want to do. And so it's a lot larger than me, and it's a lot larger than me getting older every day. And the 50 years, well, what I like about it is it's a golden year, you know. And Alexandra Vrabelov, she titled her piece "Gold Came from Space," and
that has been written for you.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah.
In this specific year for this celebration.
That's right. Yeah.
Did she say that explicitly? This is just an allusion to golden Hochzeit or golden jubilees.
She did not say that explicitly quite.
Okay. But she was kind of hinting.
She was. Okay. Yeah, she was. Okay. Definitely.
Paul, you are a fairly young member of the Kronos Quartet, and when you were born, the quartet existed already for 10 years, and I wonder how you came across this group first and what that meant for you and how it developed for you being a member of the group now.
I came across my first Kronos Quartet recording when I was 8 years old of Black Angels, and I don't think I had reached the age limit yet to hear that.
It was absolutely terrifying.
I was too young for horror movies, and I think I was too young for Black Angels for a few more years. I rediscovered the album in high school, which is when I first really understood how important it was, both to the musical world at the time, and to me as a teenager and as a young cellist, sort of deciding what I wanted to do with cello. Was music the path that I was meant to follow or not? And Kronos certainly helped me decide. And that recording in particular sort of exploded my path into many, many, many different options. And around the same time, I started dipping a toe into arranging and improvising and jazz and, you know, recording four cello arrangements of Pink Floyd songs and Radiohead and Jimi Hendrix. Cool. And my favorite movie tunes and, you know, all of this stuff that, you know, I should have been at home practicing scales. But so at that point in my life, Kronos was sort of permission, which I realize now that I desperately wanted. And I try to stress with the young people I work with now that you have to give yourself that permission. It doesn't come from anywhere else. But back to your question, I've had a couple of intersection points with Kronos since then. I first met and interacted with David in 2018, I believe, when he asked me to compose a piece for the 50 for the Future project, which is just one of the greatest musical initiatives that was ever conceived, to make 50 new pieces by 50 wonderful composers available to young people and to everyone for free forever. No matter where you live or what instrument you play, you can download a piece by Philip Glass, Missy Mazzoli, me now, and go learn it without having to worry about any of the logistics or red tape. So that was my first introduction to Kronos, was to write a piece for this incredible project. And then it happened that my predecessor, Sunny Young, she was on maternity leave, and she asked me to fill in for her with the quartet. So we had a wonderful time going on tour for a few months, and I had this sort of insight into the life and the dreams and the humanity that is David and John and Hank. And that was also such valuable information to have when composing a piece for these human beings. And so at the time, it was just kind of a composer's wildest dream to get to play with the group that you're writing for. And then somehow, fast forward a couple years, and the opportunity came up to join the group. And it just, everything about it was right and felt right to me. And there was a lot of chemistry, and the music making was incredible. And of course, it was a sort of a strange full circle moment for me to now join the group that was responsible for creating the path that I've been traveling on as a musician for these last couple of decades. So yeah, it's been quite wonderful.
So the group that kind of initiated you into your own musical development and into the freedom that was.
Yes, and not just me, but my whole generation.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And it's sort of wonderful to I feel sort of a representative of my generation now in Kronos. And yeah, it's hard to put into words how wonderful it is.
You just mentioned Hank and John, and one of the benefits of speaking to you again today is that I meanwhile had the privilege to hear your concert in Hamburg on that very night where we spoke in the afternoon. And there came this beautiful, I wouldn't say heartbreaking, but heart-wrenching moment when you would publicly let people know that Hank and John would leave by June, which is like in 10 days' time. I don't know which date will be the exact date for them to retire from the Kronos Quartet, and you know how people responded, and I bet they do respond the same everywhere, because I mean they are so closely and utterly linked to the history and the success and the uniqueness of this ensemble. I think one was 45, the other 46 years. You know it better, of course. Isn't there, besides wishing them well and being happy to have spent so much time together, some little bleeding heart coming every now and then in the mornings when you wake up and say, oh, now it's 10 more concerts with them and then they are gone?
You know, that is not happening
for
me.
Really?
It's not. It's not that I will not miss them. And it's not that I haven't had a beautiful time these 45, 46 years with getting to play with Hank and John. It's been really fabulous, and we've shared a whole lot of life together. Mm-hmm. We've gone through a lot. And in the end, you're making your notes, and you look down at your bow, and you look at your fingers, and the note is done.
Then it lingers for a while.
It lingers for a while. And there's millions of those that Hank and John and I have done together. I feel them, you know. And I have a lot of music that I want to do in the future.
So there's no talking about this is like the prelude to a major change in the quartet, leading to David Harrington saying, oh, by the way, I could also take a leave from the Kronos now and retire.
You know, the idea of retiring is not something that I've ever really considered, because like I said, I'm doing exactly what I've always wanted to do. That is to have a hand in establishing what music might be next. Uh-huh. I've wanted to do that since I was a little kid. And I'm feeling like we're able to do that better and better every day. So I'm not tired of this. Of course, you know, you jet lag is jet lag, but I've had the same jet lag for 50 years.
You must be used to it in a way, yeah.
Well, I don't know if I'm used to it, I just deal with it.
Yeah.
And for me, it's the price that you pay to get to do the work that we get to do. But I guess in answer to the question, I'm looking forward to Ayane Kozasa and Gabriela Diaz joining Kronos.
New members.
Yes. And like Paul just said, they have grown up with the work of Kronos. And when we've played together, I feel like these people know our music better than I do. Mm-hmm. And so I'm going to be learning a whole lot of new things. So I'm looking at it as an opportunity. And in terms of where we might be able to make a real impact and a real difference in the future of not only the string quartet, but maybe a little bit of an impact on our troubled society, especially in the United States. I can't back away from this. I can't do it. There's a whole lot of stuff that's just calling for the experience of these last 50 years to keep pushing. And that's how I see it.
So it's a sense of responsibility mixed with joy?
Yeah. Yeah.
That's fantastic. I mean, this is one of the reasons, I guess, why so many musicians really never stop until somehow they just die, you know, because there's no ending in a way. The music is so mysteriously opening all the time new areas where have you never been before, even if you have made 50 years of string quartet experience with a thousand of commissioned works and stuff, and still there's something new to discover.
Well, and what's going on right now is people are writing more and more interesting work. There's never been a time in the last 50 years that's more exciting than right now for the world of music.
I think, speaking of string quartets, one of the good things for young composers is the fact that they can really write short pieces, you know? Old string quartets used to have like at least 3-4 movements. You had to work your ass off in order to compose all this, and who would then perform it, you know? And now it's almost like in pop music. You can commission to people who are maybe not terribly experienced with writing for string quartets just to give it a try for a 4-minute piece or so. Is there something like there must be a discernment, and I'm curious to learn more about the discernment in terms of quality of a piece. What makes you decide, oh, they have written this for us, so we're going to play it, or they have written it for us, but we're not going to play it because it's maybe not exactly what we would like to play. Is there such an instance in your group?
Well, before I answer that question, I want to tell you about the very first piece Kronos rehearsed. Webern's Six Bagatelles.
Oh.
And that's about 3 minutes and 45 seconds in total,
yeah.
I think. And it's like a six-movement opera with no words. And it's one of the most amazing works that there is.
You're totally right. You're proving me wrong on the duration part of the thing. And of course, Webern was responding with this to history in a way, and totally condensing everything. And
right.
Yeah.
Right. The idea that, there are a lot of people that have written very long works recently.
Mm-hmm.
Terry Riley's Salome Dances for Peace is over 2 hours long. Morton Feldman's Second String Quartet is, depending on your tempo, can be 6 hours, can be 4 hours. If you play it really fast, it could be 2 hours. But the idea of length is something that composers have been experimenting with a lot. There is something that happens over a long period of time that doesn't happen usually in a shorter work. And what that is mysterious. But there's also something that happens in a very short piece that doesn't happen in a long piece. So it's, you know.
Yeah, well, there's something you told me when we were talking about the 50 for the Future piece. You know, as a composer, we're all sort of obsessed with the time. Well, how long do you want the piece to be? You know, is this going to be a 3-week project for me? Is it going to be a 2-year project? Like, how many minutes? And David said, you know, it's however long the piece needs to be to say what it needs to say. You know, so there was some flexibility and freedom there. But just the concept of a piece being as long as it needs to be to say what it needs to say is something that I think about every piece that I write, you know. And if someone wants a piece that's 3 minutes long, well, that's an incredible, incredible challenge for a composer to, you know, you're thinking about the people traveling to see the performance that's going to feature this 3-minute work and the time it takes to get dressed and call a taxi or whatever and go buy your ticket, get seated, you know, to hear 3 minutes. What are you going to tell them in this 3-minute window? It's incredibly, it's a challenge. And every piece written for Kronos, I think the composers are thinking about that, the value of the time and the platform that they have. So it's the durations of the music vary greatly.
Mm-hmm.
Even from one composer can write us a sure. 5-minute piece and then a 40-minute piece. And each one is so different in what they achieve and what they strive for and what they give us.
So meaning that you would never say, we wish a 10-minute, 15-minute piece from you. You just leave it totally to the composer's gusto?
For that particular project for the 50 for the Future, there was a sort of idea of how long each piece would ideally be for the sake of, you know, future performers and future students. But there was flexibility within that, you know, and I think a couple of composers submitted pieces that were 5 or 6 times longer than what, you know, Kronos had suggested, which is that's how long they needed for the piece to say what they needed to say. So there are, of course, suggested lengths, and then we go from there.
And sometimes there might be a concert that we're planning, and we have everything figured out except one piece. And we have, you know, we sort of know the lengths of everything else. So we have a 15-minute window. I would explain that to the composer. I would say, okay, we've got everything figured out, and there's a 15-minute place. Your piece doesn't have to be 15 minutes. It shouldn't be much over that because, you know,
then
the balance of the evening would get thrown off, perhaps. But even that, what Paul was just saying, that it's important that every composer writes the piece she or he has to write. That's absolutely essential. And one of the things we can do is choose the time that whatever composer it might be, choose the time when that person should write for us. And I do spend a lot of time thinking about that. Okay, this happened in this person's life. Now, how are they going to respond in their music? What are they going to be able to tell us now from their experience? That, to me, that's important.
That's very beautiful. That's almost like an editor with an author, you know, just living with that person and just knowing, are there something new coming and helping probably even, or wanting to, you know, sometimes you need to pull something out of somebody who is maybe stuck in some ways. And I know that you have a number of composers like Terry Riley, you mentioned him, and Alexandra Rebelov also, because she has written over 10 pieces for you. So there are some composers that you are really so friendly with, that you know enough about their lives that they, that you say, ah, now's the time for a new piece for us.
I'm interested in creating bodies of work. Mm-hmm. And I think Haydn proved it beautifully. Beethoven proved it beautifully. Many other composers have, that practice is a good thing. And one tends to get better with experience. And one sometimes is able to access more internal information on future works. And I'm fascinated by that. You know, Henrik Gorecki still owes Kronos his fourth string quartet. I mean, he died a number of years ago, but he told me exactly what he had in mind for that piece. Exactly. And it was going to be a short piece. It was going to be fun. It was going to be wild. And
you occasionally dream of that piece.
I do.
That's being written.
I do. And it was so clear. I could see it in his face and his voice. I knew exactly what this was going to be like. And so I'm still waiting, Henrik.
You have worked quite a bit with Gorecki. And what was the strongest experience, the most revealing experience that comes to your mind when you think of him, working with you, writing for you, rehearsing with you?
This is a very personal response to what you just asked. It was a month and a half after my son died in 1995, and I met Henrik. And I showed him a picture of Adam. And through a translator, I was able to tell him what happened. And he looked at the photo, and he just shook his head. And then there was silence for quite a while. And then he told me what the third string quartet was going to be about.
Whoa.
And the third string quartet did not arrive for 10 years. That's how long it took him to be able to write the piece that he wrote.
Would you say that he kind of conceived this piece when he was looking at the photo, or was it something non-related to this
moment
between you?
I don't know that.
Okay.
I don't know that. I think it might have been something that he felt he could reveal after that. But that experience of loss is something that is with me every minute.
Mm-hmm.
And all the composers that write for us know that, because I think it's, it's an essential part of my life. And one of the things that it has done is it has pushed me to want the best for more and more people. And so it's my response to my son's death has to do with making music stronger and better if I possibly can. And my instrument is not really the violin, it's the string quartet. And so that's how I express that. Is
how old was your son when he passed away?
16.
Oh. Was it your only child, or do you have
more? No, our daughter is 3 years older than Adam. Mm-hmm. So she's now in her late 40s. Yeah.
Yeah, profound. So profound. Life is so. And it's beautiful to have music as the creative.
Yeah. Well, on the day before Adam died, Terry Riley rang our doorbell, and Adam answered the door. And Terry had known Adam almost his whole life. And eventually Terry wrote a piece called Requiem for Adam. And we haven't played that for many years, but I'm thinking it would be wonderful to do it again sometime. Yeah.
Sure. Let's talk a little bit again about this 50 for the Future project that you have apparently launched some 5-6 years prior to the 50 years existence, knowing that some composers might maybe take a little longer, or you wanted just to finish it. It was finished even before last year, right? It was finished in 2021 already. So what guided you to those composers? I mean, some obviously were obvious because they were just in your close surrounding, but were you actively searching for certain people, trying to find out this would be good to have as a voice in this compendium of 50 pieces for people?
Yeah, I mean, basically, my approach was, well, we've had a lot of experience with a number of composers. Some of them, let's include in the 50 for the Future, but let's have a good time and learn some new things with people that haven't written for us yet. And then there were other instances where, now I want to be sure every string quartet in the universe gets to play music by Tanya Tagok, for example. that's really important to me.
Yeah.
How long did it take for Kronos to have a body of music written by African-born composers? Mm-hmm. Well, it took years for that to happen. The first 50 for the Future piece that was completed was by Lasana Diabate, mm-hmm. from Mali. And speaking about lengths of pieces, what he did is he made a solo movement for each member of the group.
Oh.
And it's so generous what he did. And it's so much fun and beautiful. And and then the fifth movement is kind of for everybody.
Then they all come together.
Yeah. Right.
What brought you to this idea in the first place? I mean, besides from having this generous idea of having just a body of work for people that can be downloaded and rehearsed for free, recorded for free even, I've been told. Why would you do this in the first place?
There was one particular experience that convinced me that we needed to make a change. And it had to do with young people not having direct access to scores and parts in their university, in their music libraries. And it was when...
Even of pieces that you had premiered and that should be have a publisher and everything?
I mean, how many music libraries in the United States have the music of Terry Riley, the string quartet music? Goretzky, Steve Reich, Philip Glass. Maybe now it's improving.
Yeah.
Improving. 10 years ago or so, when we were thinking of this, it was really tough to locate our music in a public way. You know, you could rent it from a publisher if you knew how to do that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that's something that you learn to do with practice. It's not generally taught. At least when I went to school, it wasn't taught.
Yeah.
I had to learn to do that. But anyway, so what happened is one day I was invited to coach a group. They were going to be playing Black Angels by George Crumb. And nobody had ever asked me to do this, to coach a group doing this. And I was really looking forward to it. Okay. And I show up at the coaching And come to find out, the professor whose responsibility it was to get the music for the students got them the music the night before my coaching. And, you know, you've heard about people seeing red. I saw red.
Understandably so, yeah.
That piece cannot be sight read by anybody.
No way.
And furthermore, even if you could sight read it, but then what about all the gongs and the crystal glasses and all the
additional
sounds, and the amplification needed and everything that goes into that piece. And I just felt at that moment that recent music, even though that was nearly 40 some years after Black Angels was written, it felt to me like recent music was not respected by the established teachers.
Mm-hmm.
And I found that incredibly insulting to the music, and it seemed to me that the young people were losing out on opportunities for learning new things. And that's not fair. It's not acceptable. And
true.
That was the kind of the catalytic experience and that led me to want to do something like 50 for the Future.
This was a project then that you would discuss with Hank and John and the then cellist, or was it just your initial idea? Because you are such a collaborative person, and how did you find your allies to make that possible?
Well, this was a Kronos-wide discussion. The first organization that we were in touch with was Carnegie Hall, and fortunately, they jumped on the opportunity. And as a matter of fact, Carnegie Hall wanted us to do 100 composers, and I wanted to do it. And you know, it's a good thing I got talked out of it, actually, because the 50—I mean, 100 for the future. You know, we can still do that.
I was just wondering, why wouldn't you have a second half? You know, the second batch coming.
You know. We will.
Yeah, that's yeah. No spoilers.
But nice. So anyway, we trimmed it down to 50, and then you start. It's very easy to get to 50, even in just imagining. Okay, and how are we going to do things that we've never done before? Okay, well, we'll do this and we'll do this, and it happened one piece at a time, really.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And getting back to Lawson Adiabate, we had just made a recording with his trio Dakali. And what was so beautiful and so clear was how inventive Lawson is. So we would do a take of one of the songs we were recording. And then Lasana would be at his balafone, kind of composing. And over a span of 3 days, you know, we probably had 300 takes. And so there were 300 little pieces I heard him make. And I thought, each one of these is like amazing. This is like being around Bach or something. You know,
wonderful.
You just imagine that kind of flexible creativity. Yeah. And so I thought, Have to see what Lawson will do.
He has to be part of this.
Yeah. And so in every case, it happened from that kind of a personal connection, and something drew me, us, to a composer. Something, there would be a quality that nobody else would have. That's what we were looking for.
Did it ever happen that you would reject a piece? I would ask that before, you know, the quality question. Sometimes, you know, you expect something, you're being sent some material and you find, well, we just can't relate to this. Did this ever happen?
It did happen in 50 for the Future. Mm-hmm. In fact, we had this fabulous piece, and we opened many concerts with it, and I love that piece. I love that piece. And we found out that the composer wrote very, very hateful things about another person, a reporter. Mm-hmm. And to the point where eventually this young woman took her own life. And we simply could not have that attitude, that expression as part of our 50 for the Future, no matter how much we enjoyed playing that piece. We just had to take it out.
But David, that was a moral decision, if you want to say. It was not an artistic one, because, as you say, you love to play it. And it's very respectable that you felt like, no, we can't. This is just not possible. But the other version, having someone whose music just doesn't speak to you, even though you thought it would, mm-hmm. Did this happen?
That did happen.
Yeah.
Yeah, it did. It happens very rarely, considering how involved we are in the process of making new work. It happens very rarely. But when it does happen, you have to face that, you know, because, you know, it's the group that goes out on stage, and we need to feel like there's something there that we can work with, and we
that
can
nourishes you, and that you can feed the people with, in a way.
Yeah.
To put it very plainly, on a mm-hmm. nutritional level.
Yeah,
I mean, this has been an aspect of music from the very first commission in all the world, you know, however many hundreds of years ago, of the risk.
Yeah.
And that's part of the beautiful thing, is that you're asking for something new. You're asking someone to invent something for you that may or may not work. There's no way to know until it's complete. And that's just one of the beautiful parts about writing music, actually, is that risk. And that drives people to discover more about themselves and to think more deeply about the world around them. And for Kronos, it's such a beautiful thing to be part of that process. And to, you know, that's part of what David was saying about analyzing and sort of examining where a person is now in their life, where a composer is now, and mm-hmm. looking at what they've created so far, and, well, is this the moment where we could give them that chance to just soar and do the greatest thing they've done yet? And, you know, if it's not the greatest thing they've done, and we like to work with composers as well to help them uncover new things and, you know, try to make a thing as great as it can be.
So that means you would also work with composers in their pieces and not consider them being finished. And the Holy Scripture, once it's been given to you and you have to execute it just the way it's been written down, so that can happen.
It can happen for sure, but every composer is a different, you know, they come with a universe of experience and a different language. And, you know, most music students have the luxury of learning about three or four of those universes very well inside and out in school, Beethoven, Haydn, etc. Every single composer has that universe revolving around them and that language that's being created as they live their life. And we do our best to participate in as many of those universes as we can. And, you know, writing an occasional piece that doesn't work as well as others, that's just part of the development of any human. And whether that's, you know, that can be a piece of music or anything else that happens in someone's life. You know, not mm-hmm. everything is a top 10 hit, you know.
Sure.
So it's actually a quite a beautiful part of the process, too, that we do get to see more when you are focused on bodies of work rather than a single work is that there's plenty of space for little road bumps here and there.
Mm-hmm. Seeing and listening you perform on stage, I was asking myself, do you rehearse with amplified instruments, or do you, when it's needed, or do you rehearse rather acoustically in a smaller room when you're just working on a piece? Or is it always the amp going with it?
We rehearse acoustically. And occasionally there would be something that would need to be rehearsed from the very first note with amplification, with all of the tools that we have. But normally we would start acoustically and then add layers.
Is there every now and then something like a guilty pleasure of playing one little Haydn movement in between all this contemporary works you're playing?
A Haydn movement? Oh gosh, guilty pleasure. That's an interesting way to frame. No.
No.
I mean, for me, the guilty pleasure is Laurie Anderson's Flow and Briceño's El Sinaloense. Those are real. There's nothing guilty about it.
No, that's what I'm
pure pleasure.
This is and, sheer delight. Yeah.
And we have so many friends in other quartets who live, breathe, and die for Haydn, you know, so we feel honored and grateful that they're doing that work and that we're doing our work.
Yeah. Paul, what's your vision for Kronos for the next, say, 50 years?
My vision, well...
Paul, you're going to be 90 in 50 years.
Yeah. My vision is to keep Kronos focused and to keep the trajectory strong, the trajectory that it's already on, that it has been on since the start. And, you know, it's really just fascinating to be sort of straddling these two worlds of the past and the future. And, you know, with John and Hank, two of my musical idols, to get to play with them. And then the excitement of having Ayane and Gabriella on board and what they're capable of. So to be appreciating the past and the future at the same time. I'm getting very good at that.
See that.
But the things that Kronos is capable of and the platform that we have now it's unbelievable. And at the same time that the world needs music and needs people who care more than ever before, and the fact that Kronos is in a position to be able to provide a platform for artists and other people who really have something to say and need to say it is just so unbelievably exciting to me. And I've always searched for a deeper way to live my life than just to play cello on stage and to have a good time. And everyone involved in the Kronos orbit shares that same desire and drive to, there has to be something more that we can do with music. Let's show the world what music can accomplish, mm-hmm. and what we can heal together. So to stay focused on that and to really hone in on how chamber music can make the world a better place.
Can make a difference in the world.
It can make a difference.
Very last question. Which concert will be the very last with Hank and John?
June 23rd in San Francisco.
In San Francisco,
yeah.
In your hometown.
Yeah.
And are you planning anything like super special about that?
What we're doing that day is it's the fourth day of our Kronos Festival in San Francisco. And we're doing with Sam Green, 1,000 Thoughts, which is a documentary that he made about
the film where you play live.
We play live, yeah. And it will be filmed for eventual release. And that's how Hank's 46 years and John's 45 years in Kronos will conclude.
So this will then kind of be a lasting memory for everyone in the world. Wonderful. Thank you so much, David and Paul. Thank
My
you.
Pleasure.
Elbphilharmonie Talk, der Gesprächspodcast der Elbphilharmonie. Dieser Podcast wird vermarktet durch die Podcastbude.